He's a traveling monk and Bhakti Yoga Club is very super honored that he's here. Prabhupada Swami is an inspiration for many people, including myself. I met him 7 months ago and my life changed since then. You're all very fortunate that you can hear from him. So please pay attention. And this lecture, it's about intersection of spirituality and social change. Enjoy.
He spelled it right, too.
Uh-huh. It's a tough computer. Okay. You all attended the yoga class? Well, from the over a period of several years of visiting WashU, social activism, my experience has been like it's a big theme of the spirit of the students, maybe the spirit of the school. And at least conversations that I've had with some individuals, it's kind of like it's like a measure that everything is held up against, and it's pervasive. I'll share this with you that maybe 6-7 years ago, a survey was done entering freshmen in universities in America, and a similar study universities in Europe, and there were two questions, at least the part of the survey that I read. What's the most important thing that you're considering as far as, you know, the career that you're going to move in and and therefore the major that you're going to have? And the answer was, I want to be involved in something that's going to make a better quality of experience of life in this world. Then the second question was, what about how much money you'll make? How much important is that for you? And the answer was, boo. It was my parents and the older generation, they made lots of money, and I see that they're not happy, and they made a mess of planet Earth, and I don't want to be part of that, making a mess of planet Earth. I want to make it a better place. That's what's important to me. And I'm willing to make less money. Of course, that's, you know, maybe that gets changed over time, but that's a spirit amongst younger generation entering into universities, and this is one of them. Very prominent, my experience, and even comparison to other places. So where's the connection, or is there like a Venn diagram? There's this one, and there's this one, and there must be some overlap. What's the intersection? So just some simple graphics of things right from the internet on people that are advocates of social change, making a difference to the community, to the society, to the world. Hands together, helping one another. Another collage of... It's hard to read. Can we turn the light down? Might be easier to read. Women's rights activists, children's rights activists, civil rights activists. I don't know what that one says. Environmental activists. And, you know, that's on the perimeter, and then there's all these other phrases and involvement things. Another right from the internet. What is activism? These phrases that everyone gets behind for a good reason. At the center is, you know, something that's symbolic of my college days, you know, that the peace symbol, but people working together for making a better world. better choices for a better world. And some faces and some names of some prominent, of course, Gandhi is an old fellow. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. Mm-hmm. And different persons that had their calling, their message, you know, some very current ones and some deceased ones. I like this. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? We'll make reference to this later. Compassion on the top, compassion topic. So, while there's these persons with their messages and the agencies that they founded or others inspired by them founded and are still very active, calling for justice. You're going to hear this word justice again as we go along. And there, the newer ways of getting the message and through social media and so forth. With all of those efforts, we still have an unfortunate situation where it still goes on, that the inconsistency, the anomaly, the pain of the world still goes on. Child abuse is, you know, an evolving message of terrorism and crime and social unrest, etc. And I wanted to focus on one of the pieces, because it impacts a lot of the pieces, and that's the obstacle, or a major obstacle for social change, is the very strong drive in this world for greed, you know, the attempt for prosperity. Interesting graphic, huh? There's a lot to say about this topic. I've only taken a few things. The impact on Earth planet of consumer economics says some statistics. In the past 3 decades, 1/3 of Earth planet's natural resources have been consumed. There are statistics that say by the year 2025, based upon population growth of it at its current rate and based upon wealth growth, we're going to need 2.5 Earth planets just to keep up with the demand of supply for economic growth. And so that means people are fighting over the resources. Roughly 1/4 of the 50 recent wars and armed conflicts have involved the struggle for control of natural resources. The frequency of conflicts is being charted over the years, and the numbers aren't going down. In 2003, humanity's footprint exceeded Earth's biological capacity by over 25%. We're using, that's 2003, 1.25 Earth planets. There's only one. Mm-hmm. And some charts showing the number of Earths that will be needed within, you know, the chart. So it passed the year 2000, the Earth planet's capacity. You're all familiar with these things. Less than 4% of the United States' original forests are remaining. Throughout the world, 80% of the forests are gone. That means 20% is remaining. And what's that all about? It's taking advantage of the opportunity. Largely, it's cattle farming. The water supply, 40% of U.S. rivers are undrinkable. And in 1960, the per capita gross domestic product of the 20 richest countries in the world was 18 times that of the 20 poorest countries. Give it another 35 years. The gap between the richest and poorest nations had more than doubled to 37 times. So the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. The inequity of that exploitative program. As an example, in the Congo, to mine cobalt, cobalt is used for microtechnology, especially with cell phones. And so 30% of the children, child labor, is being used for mining cobalt so we people can have their... And you'll see a chart about how much cell phone use has increased. Globally, every day, 200,000 people move into overcrowded cities, live in slums, and work in toxic industries. You know, side by side with the high rises. I think this is Bombay. Big, big buildings and slums. And the inequity. The statistics can just go on for hours. Industry releases 4 billion pounds of toxics a year. Women's breast milk has been valued as being higher than regular milk. 1.2 million fatalities on the job each year, or that's 3,300 deaths per day, and 160 million new cases of work-related diseases. And I think that's a worldwide figure. I hope it's a worldwide figure. So many researchers have come to the same conclusion without all the rest of the statistics. There's no longer any serious scientific dispute that the decline in every living system in the world has reached an extraordinary threshold. So that's just, you know, planet Earth. I'll just share this with you. The much larger, whole hour's worth of going into details and different angles and so forth, I made a presentation on spiritual economics at Penn State University some years ago. And the persons that were organizing the program specifically went to the humanities buildings, and the place was filled. There were, I don't know, nearly 100 people, students attending. And I found out in the course of the question-answer session, because one of the students stood up and raised his hand, but stood up and said, maybe you're wondering why there's so many of us here. It's because there's a professor that teaches for a whole semester what you've been saying for 1 hour. So, you know, we've got it up to here. And everything that you're saying is right on, and more. But I'm speaking only for myself, but I think I'm speaking for the other students in the audience. That although I know all these facts and statistics of, you know, the Earth planet is being used and burned and scorched and pillaged, and people fighting over the resources and all that stuff, it's something like, you know, if we're on a train and we get a report that the bridge is out, running over the ravine, I know that I don't want to, knowing all these things, I don't want to have a different standard of living than my expectation. I'm going to keep going. And looking around the room, you know, no one is saying, no, we don't want to keep going. So the information of, it's a challenge for social activists. Because the greed, going back to that principle, the guy eating the earth, the greed is so strong that even you know it's a great danger, then conserving or consuming less is it's hard. for some people. There's where the spirituality and the social activism intersect. Right there. You know, that the relieving oneself of that very, very strong tendency. And I'm going to play a little video for you in just a moment that's addressing how we got there. We didn't get there by chance. It was by design. Here's where's the cell phone? Cell phone use. It's right off the chart. We need the cobalt for that, so the child labor in Congo. And all these other, you know, radio, telephone, electricity, clothes washers, clothes dryers, and, you know, everything. The consumer report. The title of an article where this comes from is "You Are What You Spend" from New York Times. This is a quote you're going to see in just a moment. The Eisenhower administration post-World War II set an economic council to work on how to restore the economy and develop the economy. And this is their conclusion in summary. So that's a... You might want to write this down, because I'm only going to give you a video clip of a portion of the long message. Have any of you seen this story of stuff before? Okay. So, just disappear. Oh, there it is. Maybe we won't show it. Huh? Was not letting me play it. But that's okay.
Okay. I actually have it on this computer.
You do?
We have become a nation of consumers. Our primary identity has become that of being consumers, not mothers, teachers, farmers, but consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this arrow, how much we consume. And do we shop and shop and shop, keep the materials flowing, and flow they do. Guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after their date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. 1. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. Now, how can we run a planet with that level of materials throughput? It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisors chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even big stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues, even everything. Even computers. Have you noticed that when you buy a computer now, the technology is changing so fast that in just a couple of years, it's actually an impediment to communication? I was curious about this, so I opened up a big desktop computer to see what was inside. And I found out that the piece that changes each year is just a tiny little piece in the corner. But you can't just change that one piece because each new version is a different shape. So you gotta chuck the whole thing and buy a new one. So I was reading industrial design journals from the 1950s when planned obsolescence was really catching on. These designers are so open about it. They actually discuss how fast can they make stuff break that still leaves the consumer having enough faith in the product to go out and buy another one. It was so intentional. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I'm at a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us, you suck, so you gotta go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you gotta go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and tells you go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we...
The first part was, as you saw in that diagram, was how the earth is being pillaged, and then the factory part, and then the consumer part, and then the waste part. Greed. And, you know, in so many different ways, this is explaining one, the story of stuff way, but in so many different ways, the subtler ways of achieving and being successful and what's meaningful and all of those things. So one of the solutions for, there's a whole lot to say, and I'm only just doing one slide here, but there's a whole lot to say about, we just should need to recycle and use green economy, green economics instead of the other one. However, that doesn't solve the consumption disease. In other words, the greed is still there. And that means, you know, the dissatisfaction within, because the greed is still there. Whatever you have, green, you want more, or it's more variety, etc., etc. The inner satisfaction isn't achieved. And many of the solutions, I could go into details, but, you know, the solutions have their side effects. It solves one problem or diminishes one problem, it creates another problem. It's insufficient for the crisis. And finally, it doesn't address the lack of spiritual well-being. The whole body of Vedic literature or wisdom literature from ancient India speak just on this point, first and foremost on the point that when there's inner satisfaction, then the sense of need of something outside of yourself for satisfaction is diminished because you're already satisfied. And so you accept what you need and not go for more and go for more, because when you don't have satisfaction within, you're going to look for it some other way. Doesn't solve the problem. What's this one? Oh yeah, okay. So now, in different ways, let's say in a governmental way or an organized group way, let's bring about reform of how things are happening, but greed is still right behind it. And people that will do whatever they have to do to satisfy their greed or increase their profit or get money, because money brings happiness, it's right behind the people that are, it's part of the problem, even when trying to make change. The fabric of modern society, with its competitive and greed-based spirit, works against social upliftment. Just like that student at Penn State that spoke on behalf of, at least he was on behalf of himself at least, but other students, that even I know the perils of destroying the Earth planet. I don't want to go, I want to live my life with a certain expectation of well-being and standard of living. I don't want to make that change. So while we have bigger houses, this is a classic, there's smaller families. We have more conveniences, but we have less time. There's more media, but less communication. More experts, but less solutions. More medicines, less health. More reform, less peace. More of everything, but less universal happiness. More social unrest, more crimes, more depression. And this is the spiritual concern, or the reverse is the spiritual solution. Less connection with who we are. So when there's the spiritual connection with who we are, and then in turn with one another, who one another is, our social needs, our internal satisfaction needs are met, and then this other thing of seeking happiness outside of ourselves in exploitative ways and so forth, with nature and with one another, it's addressed directly. So spirituality, or placing God in the center, is the message this evening. They don't clash with one another. There's an intersection between bringing about social change and spirituality. Lots of good intentions. I could share this. Something that I learned when I was like 7 years old was this lesson: good intentions are not good enough. Little story. I forget what they call them, those little insects that have many wings, and they in the cycles of 13 years they come around.
Cicadas.
Huh?
Cicadas.
Okay. So when I was 7 years old, they came to, I was living in upstate New York. And, they come in swarms. It looks like a cloud. Mm-hmm. Although it's daytime, it looks like it's night. And they land on the trees, and you can hear them chomping away at all the leaves of the trees. And when those leaves are gone, they zoom off to wherever the next bunch of trees are and just feast away. So my mother gave me one of those pump things with Black Flag and said, spray the garage because they may get in the garage. So I was, you know, trying to be helpful, and I saw our kitty cat over there, and I sprayed the kitty cat because I didn't want the kitty cat to get any of those insects bothering the kitty cat. And then, you know, woke up in the morning, the kitty cat's dead in the garage. So my intention was good, but it wasn't good enough. It was misguided. That was a hard lesson to learn, that good intention is not good enough. And one could say the same thing about trying to bring about needed change. Good intention is really good, but how are we going to get genuine, sustainable, and substantial change or welfare if we don't change the inside? Here's another little sharing. Similar, it's different, but it's similar. I had a super health situation once upon a time, some 12 years ago, without the detail. So I started, I didn't want to go allopathic medicine, so I went to India and I was recommended 3 or 4 different Ayurvedic doctors. I found one out of them that I felt confidence in. And he was good. It really, really enormously helped my health. So I went periodically. And one of the times that I went, he had received charitable donations to build an Ayurvedic-like hospital. And he was really happy. So he wanted me to come. So, you know, from the top floor down to the bottom floor, this is what's going to be inside. And we got to the bottom floor, and he said, this is where we're training our staff. Now, he put his arms across his chest like this and said, I'm very confident that through Ayurveda, the imbalance of the doshas within the body can be brought back in balance. But if somebody goes back out and has the same lifestyle, they're going to have the, it's going to go back again. Bungee cord. It's just going to go back to where it was. What's really needed is change of lifestyle. So we need to team up with you people because you can help people change their lifestyle, because it's something that's within. It has to change before you can change your lifestyle. Like this fellow was saying, you know, intellectually I know what's happening to the planet Earth, but I don't want to change my expectations. I'm not ready to change my lifestyle. So how are you going to change the inside without something that changes the inside? Just by social change. Like trying to reshape how behavior. It's going to come out again anyways. So how are we going to get this, you know, good intention that has substantial, sustainable, genuine change? There's these two Sanskrit terms, shreyas, which means long-term, and prayas, which means short-term. You may get people to change something for a while. But if greed is still there and the contaminations of heart are still there, it's going to find some other way to leak out. It doesn't behave this way, it behaves that way. It's going to come out. What's inside comes out. Therefore, the spiritual solution is like break free from material existence altogether. We still have bodies, we have to service them. But unless there's a greater happiness from within, or contentment from within, a deeper understanding of who we are on a deeper level, that spiritual solution connecting with social change, it's not going to sustain. So, you know, these core questions that people generally are too busy to ask. Where do I come from? Who am I? Where am I going after this situation? Searching for the welfare of the inner self or the soul. I like this. This indicates it's heading for being connected again with Krishna. Now, a little skit is, I'll tell you, we did this at our center in Brooklyn. It was a gathering where there were about 200 people attending a Sunday evening gathering, and there was a speaker, And it was arranged that you know, over in the corner, there was kind of this eccentric person. Everybody knew he was eccentric. And it was set up. He started he's right in the middle of the class. He stood up and kind of was writhing and reeling and saying, "Help! Help! Help!" And everybody freaked out. What's going on? Maybe he's got a heart attack or something. And then somebody else was prearranged, stood up and said, "I'll help you. I'll help you, man. What can I do to help you?" And "Help! Help!" So he took his jacket or coat or whatever, some outer garment, and then brought his outer garment. I'll help you, man. And then he ended up collapsing on the floor. It was a spoof on this same type of idea. Here's a drowning man calling for help, and someone very kindly goes and rescues his coat. Well, the man is still drowning. So, you know, the intention is good, but it's, you know, the person inside is that the spark of life or who we really are, and we need to attend to the coverings for sure, the body and the mind and the intelligence and our social needs and so on. Spirituality doesn't restrict us from helping others in practical ways, but there's a whole other dimension that spirituality also touches and deals with directly. Here's just some illustrations of that from, you know, spiritual organizations. This is a hospital where the staff members are being trained in spiritual teaching so they can administer. I'll share this with you. In the year 2010, I served our global society as chairman of our governing body commission. It was a very interesting experience. I'm not looking forward to it again anytime soon. During that year, there was that, whatever it was, hurricane or disaster in the Caribbean, next to Santo Domingo, which country?
Haiti.
Haiti, thank you. So I was the chairman, and I was getting these emails and phone calls from people from all over the world saying, "What's ISKCON doing to help? Can I help? I want to get involved and help." No one ever taught me, you know, what do you do when something like that comes up? But as I just put two and two together, we have to have a point person that everyone can contact. So I knew a really capable person in Santo Domingo, and he also spoke French, and he was willing to be the contact person. So a person from all over the world. It was a wonderful experience. Volunteered, they gathered up resources and went there for medicine, and I met some of them. I just happened to pass through in an airport. They're on their way to go to Haiti. Said, what's your thing? I know how to build houses from next to nothing. And I know how people can, you know, grow crops so they can have something to eat. And I know how to do, you know, we're bringing clothing and medicine. Said, that's fantastic. And then they explained, we've done this before, and one of the things that's really important to us, along with administering these things, you know, food and medical care and building their homes again, is we want to give them a spiritual method, just some spiritual shelter. So it'll be sustainable. You know, their sense of well-being will be cared for inside, not just outside. God consciousness means to understand the personal nature of God and how every living entity is of value as a part and parcel of that same Supreme. So there's this connection, and then there's, you know, the social connection, the position of all living beings, and not just human beings, but all species of life. Every living entity is of value as a part and parcel of God. Thus, spirituality does not limit our goodwill to other human beings only, rather it expands to all members of God's creation, including animals, trees, etc., spelled wrong. So, I was just, for those of you that are interested, the Hare Krishna movement's been around for 50 years. We're celebrating our ISKCON 50. Yay! So, when it was formed in 1966, since 2016, there was, in the state of New York, when you incorporate, you have to have a statement of purposes. So there's seven purposes, and one of them is this. One of the purposes of ISKCON is this. Stated differently, language is different, but to bring into the world this understanding that all forms of life are to be valued or of value, because inherently they're the spark of life that's within. And then compassion can expand to all the different forms of life, and here's some of them. And we may not want to go embrace the crocodile, but we value the form of life of all living beings, not just human beings. However, you know, the society or civilization that pays attention to the outside and not to the living entity that's within the cage, the living entity within the cage can croak, polish the cage, but not feed the entity that's within. By spiritual practices, we cleanse ourselves of selfish thoughts and inspire others to similarly cleanse themselves, thereby addressing the root cause of suffering. So this is a little diagram showing the Vedic picture of who we really are. So that's who we really are. A little different. But that's the soul within. And then the soul within is covered by a subtle body. You'll find this in Bhagavad Gita, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And then there's an outer covering around the subtle body, that's the gross body. So then there's elements that make up the gross body as well as the subtle body. But inside, that's who we are. And spiritual practice helps to cleanse the whole thing by this spiritual well-being and awakened state of our spiritual consciousness that helps to spiritualize the coverings as well. Genuine good qualities such as compassion naturally awaken within a spiritual person. And if that's not there, if the spiritual awakeness is there, it's unstable, flickering. Here's another drawing that shows essentially the same thing. There's the soul within, the subtle body covering the soul, and the gross body covering that. According to Bhagavad Gita's message, there's modes of nature that are acting on both the subtle and the gross body. This is goodness, this is passion, this is ignorance, and springing out of whichever mode of nature where it primarily influenced by, then you'll get behavior. So if you want social activism to really work, then connecting the soul in goodness is necessary. And sustained goodness is going to happen when their spiritual consciousness is awakened. And then it's consistent. You'll get consistent social change with their spiritual awakened condition. Compassion being one of those qualities of goodness. We're almost done. Compassion is really nice. Sustained compassion is even more nice, or nicer. Dictionary definitions I cut out a lot, but you look at in the dictionary and you'll find different components from the dictionary of what compassion is. It has to do with some feelings, something that you recognize in another, and then some motivation you want to do something. So there was a study, a 12-year study done by an individual who wrote a book about it and his group of people. They were studying Fortune 500 companies, and over that period of 12 years, those that were Fortune 500 companies, he He wrote a book called From Good to Great, or something like that. And he wanted to see what made those great. And what made them great was compassion. And these three elements combined or reduced down to two of them. One was when the CEO wasn't just profit-driven or greed-driven, but was moved by humility. Interesting. Because the picture of a corporate guy is aggressive. They use that language all the time, like all the time. Aggressive. But the best or greatest achievers are those that are humble. They have ambition, but their ambition is to do something for others. Like social activism. You want to do something for others. You're really driven by that. And you can't be stopped. Just because it's inside, it comes out. What's going to keep that sustained? Like this, Ayurvedic doctor said, or the student at Penn State said. It's not just by knowing something. There's when there's something within, there's a spiritual awakened state of consciousness that sustains these efforts. Passion doesn't endure. So it's not easy to, on a collective conscious level, bring others to the position of spiritual well-being and social well-being. It's not easy. Definitely not easy. But it does happen when there's a light inside. My proposal this evening is when that spiritual consciousness is awakened, then these other effective changes can become possible. And that's the last slide. Put God in the center and everything will come together. I had some other graphics, but I ran out of time. Okay, so any comments or questions? We can turn the light on, see if there's any discussion on this. Yes.
You mentioned a lot of scary statistics about how the Earth is dying and we're using all the resources. Do you also feel any optimism for where we are now? That people are living longer and people are living more peacefully now than ever before.
More peaceful?
Per person, I guess.
Where do you get that idea? That's not my perception. It's not what statistics say. The report of people feeling, expressing their feeling contentment is going down. In fact, those nations that are more prosperous, it's specifically, there's a professor at University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League school, who did a 12-year study and named the principal of his findings after himself. Professor Enderlein concluded the Enderlein principle, which was, with prosperity, one would expect people have more choices, and you have more choices, you have more freedom, that then you will report greater happiness. More choices, more freedom from prosperity. But it indicates the opposite. The more the prosperity is there, there isn't a report of greater happiness and contentment. Professor Barry Schwartz of Swarthmore University has how professors do. They just made up some language and wrote a book about it. The satisfizers and the maximizers was his term. So it would seem that when people have a better education and therefore the more opportunity for better job, and with more opportunity, better job, greater wealth, then you would expect them be more happy, but they don't. That isn't what happens. He's a sociologist. His studies is, again, just the opposite. And over and over and over again. Over and over and over again. Because economists, they want to grow the economy. And people that are into marketing want to know what the consumers want. So they study these things. People get money to, you know, do these studies and find out how to ramp up the economy. It's not about greater satisfaction. That's what studies show, consistently. I mean, I don't know of a study that shows the opposite. I know of many studies that show less satisfaction, greater. So there's presumptions in wealth brings happiness because it brings opportunity for more choices. Doesn't. Sorry. Very sorry. So I you want to continue with your question?
I definitely agree with you that there's, especially in wealthier countries, not much happiness, but on a global scale, like the life expectancy is going up, there's less people in poverty, less people as a percentage in wars. So there are a lot of bad things, but also some good signs. Is it okay to feel optimistic, or should we still reflect on
it? Well, I'm not sure I agree with your statistics. Certainly there are, you know, there's populations that are, they're feeling greater hope. I visit China. Population of China is just knocks your socks off. I mean, I could give some examples. Are you from China?
I'm from China.
You're from China? Aren't there a lot of people in China? There's a lot of people in China. So I've asked some of the people in China, do you think the quality of life over, you know, since the, you know, the expansion of the economy of China has kind of shifted from an agrarian based economy to an industrial based economy, that people are now happier because they have more wealth and they have more stuff because they have more wealth? I mean, I can give anecdotal things, but that, you know, on a bigger scale, the statistics aren't, it's not. I mean, it's not just in Beijing, you know, the air is lethal. I took a car ride, it's anecdotal, but I took a car ride from Shanghai to Hangzhou. And it's like, you know, 4-hour car ride. And you can see about, you know, half a mile, and everything else is just dark. Because the air is so polluted. Has the quality of life really increased? Because now people have more economic growth, development? I don't think so. I don't think so. But, you know, supposing whatever that percentage of the world is, that because they have some things that they didn't have, they were deprived before, and now they have some wealth, and now they have some things. So there's a sense of greater contentment because before they didn't have those things, and now they have those things. I get, you know, maybe another time I'll do this, the entire spiritual economics thing. You know, person after person after person, of course you can get advocate for the other side, which is kind of what you're doing. Isn't there another side to this picture? But a gentleman who, just another example, who was with the World Bank, you know, his job was to get people to buy globally to find new markets. And as he saw what happened to the quality of their life, down and down and down. They buy into the paradigm of, you know, get Coca-Cola and have, you know, a new style of clothing and whatever. The quality of life has gone down. So now he advocates just the opposite. He quit World Bank and now he's an advocate for doing those things that are sustainable. And those things that are sustainable, it's a long discussion. It gets back to the earth. And, you know, living from what the earth produces. It's one of the things that our organization is, it was asked by our spiritual leader to do this long ago, and now we're just kind of getting around to maturing enough to think about it. We tried it and didn't do it so well. But, you know, a life of contentment that's based on not something that's artificial. Contentment of something outside doesn't bring satisfaction. Whatever it is that you have, you want more. You know, another one or another three or another variety or the next grade up. Or there's no contentment by having things. That's just reality. Yeah.
Is contentment within the self and compassion towards others necessarily have to do with spirituality? Like, could a person say that they not only do not consider themselves religious, they do not consider themselves to be a spiritual person or to be working towards sort of like a higher purpose? They just help others because that's just what they do, kind of thing? Does it have to be in service to God? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I understand your question.
Is there another way?
I understand your question. Thought about it a lot. Just that one slide, that, you know, the lady polishing the birdcage. There's the self within. You know, the reality, the question, the answer to your question comes down to, who are we? And there can be, certainly there can be contentment in, everybody knows, everyone that has a little goodness in them knows the contentment that you feel from going out of your way and doing something that's an act of kindness for another. We all know that feeling. Mm-hmm. Is that sufficient? Is my reply? Because are we actually touching the real self that's within? Is it our happiness, or the other person's happiness, or is it even the other person? And is it really me? You know, what's happiness without false ego? What is self with service? If we don't, a basic principle, you can say premise or principle, is who are we really? And what is life? Well, those kind of questions. Mm-hmm. So there's no.
Do we have to label it as God or spirituality?
Why
do we have to give it a
take
word?
Take another label. Take whatever label, you know, call it a. And whatever you want to call it. But, you know, the self.
Yeah.
The self. And then, you know, there's the self. And, you know, the self has coverings. And those needs need to be met, and helping others meet those needs. That's nice. And there's a sense of satisfaction in doing that. And then there's the inner self, or the soul, or the atma. There's a good one. That's a Sanskrit word. We don't know what that means. Atma. Conscious being within, the spark of life within. There's another nice one, the spark of life. And then you discover that self, and to be engaged in doing things that are acts of kindness and compassion, and sacrificing of yourself, your time, your energy, your ability, your strength, your resources, whatever God has given you, and using that for others. There's a satisfaction. It's compassion. And then there can be compassion that's displaced. I can rescue the coat, not the person, polish the cage and let the bird inside crow. But the need of the self is also to be taken care of. It's not one versus the other. That's why you know the interconnection between the two. And if, you know, somebody wants to be like, let's just leave God out of the picture, please. Because I'm uncomfortable with God being in the picture. We'll just leave him out of the picture. Well, no, he's in the picture. But we can, you know, for the time being, leave him out of the picture and just say the self. And there's myself and yourself, you know, the spark of life. Okay. And then have a philosophy or a way of life connected to a philosophy that says we just put found out that we don't, like, we don't say he doesn't exist, we just don't consider him. So I have a response to that one. But you know, then here in short, what is considered to be good, you know, in today is not what was considered to be good 50 years ago and 50 years from now. Without a standard, then what's good? I'll just give an anecdotal example. I have a friend who worked with the Board of Education for the city of New York. She was in charge of all the guidance counseling, guidance counselors for every public school in the city of New York. How'd you like a job like that? So they would, from time to time, they have Board of Education meetings. And one of the things was 12 years ago, what it took to get kicked out of a classroom. And then today, what it takes to get kicked out of a classroom. And then, you know, it's a joke. If you spoke out of turn, you were asked to leave the room. If you threw a skidwad, you were asked to leave the class. If you talk back to the teacher, you're asked to leave the classroom. Now it's, if you bring a concealed weapon, you're asked to leave the classroom. If you threaten the life of another student verbally, you don't have to, like, kill them or beat them, but just you verbally threaten them, you have to leave the classroom. And something, I forget what it is, in relation to the teacher. Threaten to kill the teacher or something, you get asked to leave the classroom. So what was, you know, standards are moving. The goalpost keeps moving. So according to Bhagavad Gita, the Vedic texts, the standards come from that person that we don't want to talk about. Dharma is the Sanskrit term that comes, the source of everything establishes the natural order of how to live harmoniously within creation, because creation comes from that source. So here's how. Here's an iPad, and with the iPad you get a user's manual. Here's how to use it. And I suppose they don't have the user's manual, I think it's meant for cracking walnuts. It can crack walnuts, but you might damage the iPad. The human form of life has a design. And if we use it according to the, you know, the designer, way that is intended, the best possible. So the best possible is to discover the self, along with taking care of the needs of the body and the mind and our social requirements, and, you know, self-discovery. And self just happens to be part of, the spark happens to be part of something. Now, maybe it's not so. Maybe it's so. Why rule it out? I just feel uncomfortable. I just rule it out. Whether it's so or not so, I don't feel comfortable. I just leave it to itself. Then standards change. What's good today is, you know.
But isn't part of the point to live in the moment and in the present? So why are you looking back to guidelines?
They're eternal. They're eternal. They're not like once upon a time, then another time, then another time.
Okay.
This is, well,
I say so, I believe you.
Well, is life simply a combination of male and female secretions, and that's what life is? Or is there a spark of life that's within, that animates the body, and when the spark of life leaves, those elements disintegrate. They integrate, and then they disintegrate. Is life just simply an integration of elements, as far as you're concerned?
No, I'm just offering up the possibility. I'm not saying I even believe what I'm saying, but I'm just putting it out there.
Okay, well, I'm responding.
Yeah, I don't think I have a set viewpoint.
Okay.
I'm open to different perspectives.
Okay. Well, if the viewpoint is, you know, inside the box there's life, inside the body there's a spark of life, then we need to acknowledge that. And if you, you know, here's an experiment, feed that spark of life and see what happens. And then do the other experiment. Don't feed that spark of life and see what happens. I know somebody that made that experiment. They were, you know, a young man, a young American fellow, you know, really happy, bright face, you know, blissful. He said, I want to be really sure. I'm not just like buying into something and, you know, I'm ramped up because, you know, somebody said be ramped up, so I'm ramped up. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop my spiritual practices and see what happens. Because I don't want to just be a blind follower. Maybe it's, you know, maybe I just find happiness some other way. So I did that experiment. I said, God, you're happy, so why change it? Why, it's not broken. Don't fix it. And he left. A year later, this young person I didn't even recognize came up to me and said, boy, you're right. I don't recognize you. Should you? But I'm Sam. You remember I left and you said it, you don't really need to do that. I got beat up really bad. I'm not leaving again. That was him. You know, maybe someone else would find happiness. They don't need to get beat up. But when you're, when there's some consistently, you know, over time, persons, my experience is, persons from all cultures of the world, their language is different, their culture is different, their color is different, their way of life is different. They, when they contact something that's a genuine connection, a genuine spiritual connection, they feel something. Consistently. I'll share this with our lady from China, because I was just in China. I've been sharing this a little bit. It's really nice. China's changing a bit. You know, the government restriction on things, including, I mean, I can't dress like this going to China, but so in Wuhan, I visited Wuhan for the first time. You know, really enthusiastic group of devotees there. And they arranged a program in a hotel. They made friends with some gentleman, and he just gave them the space. So we were there for the whole day. Because in Wuhan, there's two big Buddhist monasteries, I was told, because out of the 150 people that were there, a third of them were from the monastery. In fact, there's a lady group at the monastery, which is, I would find that interesting. So, long story short, at the end of the day, we had some chanting. And because I had shown these four pictures, chanting on beads, the meditation, down here, a nice vegetarian food. And over here was a little kid studying Bhagavad Gita. And up here were people singing and dancing. So they said, you know, we've done all these except the singing and dancing. Can we do singing and dancing? I said, why not? So they cleared all the chairs. It came from them, not from me. Cleared all the chairs away, and they got up and were doing, you know, very gracefully. And, you know, it was so nice. And then at the end, you know, questions, and one lady said, I don't know if I was doing something wrong, but tears were coming to my eyes and I was feeling feelings that I never felt before. Is that all right? It's just natural. No, contact with something that's genuinely spiritual, a touch of your heart, something happens. I mean, not everyone cries, but and feels that churning of spiritual emotion inside. They don't even know what it was, where it came from. And it happened at two other events. Just people that they never had any contact with this before. Anyway, you get the idea. You did something. regardless of culture and background and faith and, you know, something and something, without any precondition. You touch electricity, you get a shock. You connect with something that's spiritual, and you feel it. Okay, anything else? Yes.
So from your own practice and your experience, what do you think are some of the most effective and practical ways to control our greed? Because it's so part of we are human nature.
The most effective ways to do, and your voice went down.
Control greed.
Well, clean the heart. And the best way to clean the heart from teachings that I'm familiar with and my experience is through sacred sound, spiritual sound vibration. Because it acts on the heart. It directly cleanses. Chaita, Dharpa, Namarjan is the Sanskrit. It cleanses the heart. Because the other ways are mechanical. You withdraw, you check the tendency. So when there's a deeper satisfaction inside, look, as I said it before, that looking for satisfaction outside changes. Just because you're already satisfied. So best is that inner satisfaction. Inner satisfaction will come when the heart is pure. Because that's what real happiness is. It's inside. And then when you're interacting with others, it's not on the platform of what can I gain from this person, you know, the business exchange in this relationship. They satisfy me in some way, I satisfy them in some way, and that's our relationship. And looking for, you know, who satisfies me the most. Or I may be who gives me the satisfaction that I can serve them. And I get happiness from serving others. But you know that the way to overcome greed is the heart becomes pure. The heart becomes pure through a spiritual sound. Then I feel this sense of contentment, and Atmarama is the Sanskrit term, satisfaction within. Then I don't need something outside of myself. I can actually act in selfless service to others from the inside out. That's a short answer. So we have a strong emphasis on sound, sacred sound, spiritual sound. But the message of Bhagavad Gita, I'm looking for Bhagavad Gita. You have Bhagavad Gita here?
The text that describes these processes of yoga, particularly bhakti yoga, and mantra meditation.
She had something else.
Yeah?
Oh, right. So I was going to ask, so how do you keep that purified heart? Or long term, because I think at the moment we all understand and we know, you should, you know, serve others, help people, be compassionate. But I think in life it's very hard to keep this state, long term. So, how do you make it long?
Well, there's one person in the audience here that's going to be uncomfortable with my answer, but I'll have to give it anyways. by the sense of connection, or a relationship with the Supreme. As we have relationships with one another and we feel contentment, we feel some connection with one another, and a friendship or a marriage or parents and children, there's a bond. That the parents will sacrifice their lives for the safety and well-being of their children. They're doing it day by day, to speak of if there's some emergency. They'll risk their life for the safety and well-being of someone that you love. That's sustaining when it's on the platform not of getting something, it's on the platform of a loving relationship. So to sustain it, our effort is one thing, but to sending mercy is another thing. And that sustains. It sustains the connection or the not just dependent upon my effort. If I'm just solo, depending upon it, there's some strength, some conviction, some determination that's needed. Descending mercy makes the difference. That's what the term yoga means, is linking. And yoga means linking with the Supreme. So there are different systems of yoga depending upon some people are this type and some people are that type and some people are the other type. But then in the final analysis, we're all spiritual entities and we have a relationship with the Supreme. So the yoga system is compared to a ladder. In the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, you'll find that the topmost rung of the yoga ladder is being described. And then the whole sixth chapter describes how to do it, how to make that connection with the Supreme through love. Loving service. So then I have my needs met. My physical, emotional, intellectual, social, connected to the Supreme. In very practical terms. It's sustainable. It makes sense that it brings real satisfaction. And there's a strength beyond my own strength that makes it possible. That's this descending mercy, strength beyond my own strength.